Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass, and it's October 28th, 2014, and you're listening to It's All About Food. How are you doing today? So last week I mentioned I was in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm still here. And it's so nice to be in this shiny, sunny place. And I wanted to mention that I did go to the plant-based pizza restaurant in San Jose, and I want to let you know it was amazing. It's just a little funky place, but they have so much variety, and everything is vegan, and they have gluten-free as well as vegan, lots of different choices. And you know what I love the best? Of course, the food I loved, but what I loved the best was the service. There were these young kids that were working in the place, and they were so polite. I understood everything they said. They enunciated, and they were filled with so much joy. I'm not used to that. You know, you go into so many different stores and fast food establishments, and unfortunately, the service is not very good. And I wonder, is it related to the food? Can food make you feel better? Can it fill you with energy? Can it fill you with a feeling of joy and life that you want to share with other people? I think so, and I think that's what I was feeling over there. And I can't wait to go back. I'm going to try it one more time. I'm not a pizza person. Most of the time, I prefer eating whole, fresh, plant-based foods. I love my kale and my salads, things like that. But, you know, occasionally it's really fun to have pizza, and why not have it when it's cruelty-free and made from really simple ingredients that are plant-based? Whew. Okay, let's move on to the main part of the program, shall we? I want to bring on my first guest. I'm really looking forward to this, Jan Grandma Golden, and she's the author of a new children's book, Bird Lady Meets Mort and Ort, in It's a Great Day for Pulling Weeds. And you're going to find out she's a passionate environmentalist who maintains a garden that is not only a certified National Wildlife Federation habitat, but also an Audubon Bird and Butterfly Sanctuary. Jan, welcome to It's All About Food.
Karen, I'm glad to be here with you.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great, but I bet you're warmer weather than we're having right here.
Where are you?
Illinois.
Oh, chilly
today.
My goodness.
Yes, you said you're in San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah. Well, the weather is a fascinating thing to me, and I really hope that we're not wreaking too much havoc with our climate, but we know we are.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. Now, a few weeks ago, I was talking with some scientists from the Xerces Society out in Oregon, I think, and we talked a lot about native plants and beneficial insects, and we talked about the science behind it. And I think the conclusions we came to are very similar to what's in your own little book, It's a Great Day for Pulling Weeds, and I think a little bird may have told you all that information.
It certainly did. Very colorful birds at that.
So did a little bird share this with you, or how did you really come to know all that you do about gardening and taking care of the birds and the bees and the plants?
Well, I'm an avid gardener, and I just love to be outdoors. I always have. But living in a rural area now, I've been increasingly concerned about the loss of natural habitat for our songbirds, our bees, and our butterflies. And I've actually observed the decrease in the numbers of those in our small area. And even the media is even growing more concerned in this nation and, you know, around the world. And if we don't take action to preserve what we have left, then we're all in trouble in years to come. So I was actually inspired to write the book so the younger generation will be educated on the need to become more responsible stewards of our environment by becoming gardeners and reversing some of what my generation has done over the years in, you know, destroying parts of it.
Well, it's amazing to me what we've done over the last 50 to 100 years in trying to become very efficient with our food production, and not even realize what the impact was. So we're spreading all these toxic chemicals around to kill the things we don't like, bugs and the weeds right. that we don't want to sell.
Right.
And we've just destroyed so much habitat. And it's incredible when you grow these beautiful native wildflowers and grasses, and they provide seeds and food for all our beautiful friends, the birds and the bees that aren't really wreaking havoc on our agricultural produce.
We certainly have been. And it's the small things that are keeping us alive and thriving, starting with the bees and the butterflies. And some people don't know it, but I do address this in my book to educate children and those that are, you know, reading it with them. But actually about one-third of human nutrition is due to our bee pollination, and that includes the majority of fruits and many vegetables or their feed crops. And you, being a vegan, would certainly be in trouble if that was the case.
Well, you know, we'd all be in trouble, because even those people who eat animal foods, you have to grow plants to feed those animals. And
Absolutely.
If you can't grow them, you won't be feeding the animals either, so we're all in trouble.
Absolutely. We certainly are.
Yeah, and what's fascinating, I'm just always so surprised and disappointed with so many of my fellow human beings, but those of us who do garden and garden organically, the bees are thriving there. They come and they're thriving, and yet there are so many places where they're dying and they're not thriving. It's not that hard to figure out how to bring them and how to nourish them and how to protect them and how to make them thrive.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And it's the simple fact of providing what they need. We need to grow those native plants that you mentioned, you know, to attract them to our area and give them refuge within those native plants. And then by providing water for the wildlife, you know, by a bird bath or a shallow dish or a pond in your yard. And then we also need to create some protective covers, you know, in our own yards. And that, again, will draw them and protect them, you know, build some things for them to live in, grow different plants. Like one of my lessons that one of these colorful birds teaches Bird Lady is about the need to allow milkweed to grow in your gardens. They're the only plant that monarch butterflies can lay their eggs on, and the caterpillars, they drink the milk from the milkweed, and that's the only thing that they can thrive on in order to, you know, live and become a butterfly after their cocoon. So, you know, we have to be aware of ways to attract the smallest of things into our garden so that we can, you know, keep ourselves alive over time.
And the herbicides kill those milkweed plants.
That's right. That's right. And
yeah.
A lot of people, you know, they're unsightly, and the pods grow into other plants. We were able to maintain two small patches in two of our gardens around our home, and we were thrilled to be able to see five caterpillars munching away on the leaves, and they grow very rapidly. We never were able to see the chrysalis anywhere. They kind of hide those, I guess, but we were very pleased with that because butterflies are very important pollinators.
Now, what is a certified National Wildlife Federation habitat? How do you make that happen?
There are certain criteria that you have to prove to become certified. You have to provide them shelter, you have to provide water, you have to provide food, among other things. And our yard actually has all of those, and then some. We have a pond with waterfall raceways. We have bird feeders. We have bird baths. We've got the natural native grasses. We have the milkweed now, and we have a prairie garden. The birds are attracted to all the various types of flowers that we have that seed in the fall. So we provide the habitat for them to be attracted to, and we were then certified by National Wildlife Federation, and we have a plaque out by our at the end of our driveway to proudly show that we are, people who really care about the environment.
Well, I would hope that more and more places became National Wildlife Federation habitats. That should be a nice goal for people.
I would too. Definitely.
Now, what about becoming an Audubon bird and butterfly sanctuary? Is that similar with what you have to do?
Very, very similar. Very similar. They have a certain criteria that you have to provide, and you can do this, via the internet now on their website, and provide certain numbers of these criteria, and they then are able to certify you. And again, we have a plaque for them. And we just became recently certified Monarch Way Station because of, what we offer for the butterflies to also be attracted to our gardens. Our gardens surround our house, and like I said, we have a prairie garden, and we just, love being outdoors. So we love having the habitat and the critters around us.
I'm not sure how long you've been doing this garden, but has it changed in terms of the birds and butterflies that have come to make your garden their home?
Oh, definitely. We love to sit on the front porch and observe the birds that visit our bird feeders, in a matter of a half an hour. And it's amazing the different varieties that are coming. When we bought the property and built our home, we had no trees whatsoever on the property. And we've added all sorts of trees and added, for the protection, and it just attracts all different kinds of wildlife to sit back and enjoy and wonder.
So tell me about some of the birds and what they look like and what they act like. Because, a lot of us don't pay any attention to our surroundings, and we don't even see many birds. I live in New York City, and most of the time I just see pigeons.
Sure. Well, we moved out to the rural area 17 years ago. We bought property, and back then, in our grasslands where homes weren't built yet, we saw a lot of meadowlarks, and those have a bright yellow and a beautiful trill to their voice. They love to be on the highest peak of the trees and sing their hearts out. I just love them. They're actually my favorite. Mm. And then we also had bobolinks, which almost look like they had a tuxedo on. They're black and they're white. But unfortunately, with the loss of some of our grassland areas and lots that get mowed, those have disappeared almost to where I haven't seen a meadowlark very much this past several years. And I caught a glimpse of one bobolink as all this year, but they used to swarm the meadows and the grasslands. So those are two of my favorites that I don't see very often anymore. But visiting our yards, our feeders, would be the goldfinches. I love those. They're really small, bright, bright yellow. The males are very yellow, and they attract the females to their color. And during the summer months, the goldfinches are more dull. And then we have some beautiful different types of woodpeckers. We have downy woodpeckers, and we have blue jays. Cardinals in the winter are just beautiful. Those are bright red and a little more dull on the female. So we put peanuts out. Those attract the blue jays, which are, of course, are blue, and they get very protective and scare some of the smaller birds away. But, they come back as the blue jays take the peanuts we put out and carry them off somewhere else.
Now, you may not have an answer to this question, but a lot of people tell me how intelligent birds are, and I've heard so many different stories. I even have one of my own. But has anything happened with any one bird or several birds in particular that really surprised you?
Well, to start with, the two character birds in my book are very intelligent. Wouldn't you
agree? No, that's right.
They are the most intelligent ever. They teach Bird Lady a lot of lessons. But I guess you're right. I believe they communicate with one another within their species. In fact, I talk about that in the very beginning of my book, as Bird Lady is wondering, if birds really communicate, and she comes to the conclusion they really do. How else would they know to encourage their babies to start fluttering their wings and take flight, or the bluebirds in the houses that we have, bluebird houses along the driveway. You know, first the mother comes in and keeps the eggs either warm or cool, and then all of a sudden she's ready to leave, and the father comes back and he takes his turn. You know, they communicate with one another, so they are very smart within their own species.
They are, and, you know, unfortunately, we don't want to acknowledge. We could learn so much from all of them if we just paid attention a little bit.
Absolutely, and that's why my two visiting birds in my book came back to Bird Lady and taught her several different lessons about how to be more protective of the environment in her gardening practices.
Right. Now, these two birds, Mort and Ort, I've never heard of birds like that before. And they came from Noah's Ark, apparently. How is it they've lived that long?
They did, and they disappeared quickly. But they really left Bird Lady with a lot to think about and a responsibility to share with others what they learned from them. But actually, Mort and Ort Ackermort are the names of the birds. And those were names when our now 37-year-old son, Chad, was 4 years old. They were his imaginary friends' names. Now, he couldn't tell us what his friends looked like, but they were his imaginary friends' names. And I just kept them alive in my heart and wanted to, you know, have them in a book to teach children and adults alike about the lessons that they have taught Bird Lady in this book, and will in the next couple of books I plan on writing as well.
That's really lovely. I love that you kept them alive.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, you know, unfortunately, many people are frustrated feeling like everything's going wrong in the world and there's not a whole lot that they can do. And especially as we get older, people get more cynical and really feel like there's nothing that they can contribute. And yet, you are just so vibrant and doing so many wonderful different things. I'm just so enamored of the work that you're doing, and I want to thank you for that. So what is it that fuels you to keep going and to do good?
Well, I feel that, you know, it's not done until my life is done. I'm here to do what I'm doing. I was created to do what I'm doing, and I'm pursuing it. And I retired recently from a 43-year career in healthcare. I've been an RN for that many years. I taught the last 11 years of my career. And my goal when I retired were three things. I wanted to travel more, volunteer more, and write a children's educational book about nature. And I accomplished all three of those, actually, within the first year of retirement. And now I continue with my plans for my next two books that I have in mind. And I am a hospice volunteer, so I keep busy with that. I've been on our school board of education for 8 years already. And, you know, I take time, obviously, with my loving family, children, grandchildren, husband, immediate family, and just enjoy what we're doing until it's over. So hopefully I have plenty of years to complete all of that.
That's just terrific. And in your garden, are you growing food in addition to flowers and wildflowers?
Well, where we live, we're inundated with wildlife. Deer love to come to our pond and drink. They love to eat our flowers, and they devastate neighbors who ever have vegetable gardens. They just love that. We've got a lot of rabbits. So we gave up on our vegetable gardens probably 25 more years ago. Where we live, we used to have vegetable gardens, and they did quite well. And actually, when I was young, I helped my father in our vegetable garden. And that's where I learned quite a bit of what I knew about different vegetables back then. But my important job back then was to keep pulling weeds out of the garden. So right now we have flowers in the gardens, but we don't have vegetables. The only vegetables we did have this year were pumpkins. We had three very large pumpkins. We had a lot of blossoms, but they didn't materialize into pumpkins. But we had three large ones, one for each of our grandsons.
That's great. Well, Grandma Golden, thank you so much for joining me, and it's all about food.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity. I've enjoyed
You're
it.
You're welcome. I hope many, many children read and learn from your book.
I hope so, too. Thank you so much, Karen.
Okay, take care.
Mm-hmm, you too. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. So, if you're interested in this book, you might look for Bird Lady Meets Morton or in It's a Great Day for Pulling Weeds. It's really lovely, and the pictures are pretty, and I love the story. There you go. All right. We have a few minutes more before we'll take a little break, but I wanted to continue telling you about my travels here in the Bay Area. So some of you may know the Millennium Restaurant. I got to eat there last night, and I was just reminiscing how far we've come in the 20 years since this restaurant started. Millennium Restaurant started in 1994, and I remember when it first came on the scene. It was one of the first, if not the first, elegant vegan restaurants. And now in so many cities around the world, we have more and more of these restaurants to choose from. But how exciting it was when this restaurant came on the scene, where those of us who were vegan could actually go out for a celebratory, elegant evening and have a very lovely meal. And the food continues to surprise and excite. Everything they make there is very fresh and very creative. They tend to use many, many ingredients to create a symphony of some very, very unique flavors and sauces. And you won't find food like this anywhere else. We have the original Millennium Cookbook at home, and we've learned a lot from it because the chef, Eric Tuckler, he's just a genius. And he describes how to make and marinate tempeh in Millennium Cookbook, and they offer that at the restaurant as well. But it's, I don't think anybody makes tempeh as good as they do at the Millennium, except us at home, because we use their style of how to prepare it. So if you've ever had an opportunity to go there, good for you. But it was just really lovely to reflect on how things have improved and changed for the better in the last 20 years. And I'm so glad that they're still there. And I had the opportunity to speak to a doctor who is plant-based, and we shared a lot of stories about the medical community and how so few doctors know about nutrition. And I want you to know that in some upcoming programs, I'm going to be bringing on different doctors who are starting to become attuned in a hospital setting to nutrition. And these aren't the celebrity vegan doctors that we know about and have heard so much about. These are new and up-and-coming ones, and it's really exciting to see them on the scene. Okay. Why don't we take a quick break, and we'll be back in a few minutes with Dr. Susan Thompson, and we're going to be talking about food addiction. Hello, everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food on October 28th, 2014. How are you today? Well, let's get to the next part of the program, because I'm really excited to bring on Dr. Susan Pierce Thompson, who is a tenured psychology professor who has served on the faculty at several colleges and universities across the globe. Her PhD is in brain and cognitive sciences, and she specializes in the psychology and neuroscience of weight loss, willpower, and food addiction. She's the founder and CEO of Brightline Eating Solutions, a company dedicated to helping people achieve long-term, sustainable weight loss. Dr. Thompson, welcome to It's All About Food.
Hi, Karen. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this. You know, we had the opportunity to chat a while ago, and I learned so much, and now I'm so happy to share it with my listeners.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's exciting.
Yeah, and I got to listen to your webinar, which was amazing. You've just packed so much information into a couple of hours. It was great.
Thank you. Thank you. So yeah, hopefully many more to come.
Right. Well, a lot of people need this information.
Yeah,
right?
Ain't that the truth? And
yeah.
More and more, unfortunately.
So my passion is all about getting healthy, delicious food into people's mouths and making them feel good and feel better. And it's complicated because there are so many issues that surround what we choose to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is our brain.
Mm-hmm.
And how does our brain get involved with what we want to eat?
Oh, what a question, Karen. I could take the next 28 minutes and just talk about that. Well, let me just say briefly, I'll give a quick outline and then you can touch on whichever of these you want me to talk about more. One of the ways our brain gets involved has to do with the way willpower works in the brain. And a lot of people have noticed that they have good intentions about what to eat and may even know a whole bunch about what they should be eating, about nutrition and about the research behind what's best to eat, but find themselves making other choices in the heat of the moment. And so in order to really unpack what's going on there, it's very helpful to understand how willpower works in the brain. So that's one thing. That's one way that the brain gets involved. And the short answer there is that willpower is not very helpful. So you got to find strategies to work around what I call the willpower gap, which is the gap between what we know we should be doing or what we should be eating and what we actually do pick in any given choice scenario. Another way that the brain gets involved is it has to do with the fact that we have this illusion that we're making intentional choices about what and how much we eat, when in reality the brain sort of tricks us in various ways. And this is research by Brian Wansink of Cornell University. He shows, for example, that when we eat off of large plates, we eat more food than we think that we're eating, or we rely on external cues rather than internal cues to decide whether we've eaten enough. So, for example, he did this clever experiment where he had soup bowls. People were eating in his lab out of soup bowls. And as they were eating the soup, the bowls were magically being refilled by a tube from the bottom of the bowl that ran down under the table and was connected to this big vat of soup. And he would stop them periodically and say, "So are you full yet? And they'd look down at the bowl, which was still 2/3 full, and they'd look at him like it was crazy. And they didn't know that they'd already eaten like 3 quarts of soup.
Wow.
And so we rely on these cues that are not the cues that we think we're relying on. So people would be insulted if you told them, you really have no idea whether you're hungry or full. You really have no idea how much you've eaten. But the brain, so it's helpful to know how the brain works in that way. And then the other thing is it's really helpful to know about the neuroscience of food addiction, because food addiction is a very, very real thing. It doesn't affect everyone equally. Some people are really afflicted with it more than others. But getting that message out, I think the message is already out there that food is addictive, especially sugar, but also processed flour. I think that people are a little confused about what exactly is addictive. It's really sugar and flour are the culprits more than sugar, fat, and salt, which people are talking about. People are forgetting the flour, which is, I think, important. Pizza, pasta, bread, bagels, chips, crackers, those are often foods that people binge on, and it's really irrespective of salt or fat content. It's the flour that's doing it. So I'm trying to bring a more nuanced discussion about food addiction to the general public, because people are talking about food being addictive, but the, okay, so then what does that mean? Like, what next? What should someone do who's finding themselves pulled by cravings that they keep succumbing to? There isn't a lot of helpful discussion about that. So I'm trying to bring awareness around those questions.
I just want to mention, you were talking about sugar and flour, and you had made a comparison with cocaine that I found so powerful.
Yeah. So, we often don't think about where these substances come from. Where does cocaine come from anyway? Where does heroin come from? And the answer is, of course, that they come from plants, right? Cocaine comes from the coca leaf, which people in Guatemala and Colombia have been chewing on, you know, for millennia without any particular adverse effects. Chewing on a coca leaf gives you a tiny little lift that's sort of kind of like drinking a little cup of caffeinated black tea or something like that. It's a very minor effect. But when you take the inner essence of that coca leaf and you refine and purify it into a fine white powder, you get a drug. And similarly, heroin comes from poppy plants, and they're harmless on their own. But if you take the inner essence of that poppy plant and you refine and purify it into a fine powder, you get heroin. And what's sugar? Where does that come from? Well, you take a plant substance, maybe sugar cane or maybe beets or maybe corn, and you refine and purify its inner essence into a fine white powder, and you get sugar. And flour is the same way. You take natural plants that are healthy if you eat them whole, but you take a legume or a grain and you take its inner essence and you refine and purify it into a fine powder, and you get flour. And these refined substances don't hit the brain the way nature intended. They hit the reward pathway of the brain as drugs, and there is now incontrovertible evidence of that from brain imaging scans and also rat studies where you take rats and you hook them on the food, and then you look at their brain and you see that these substances have altered the dopamine reward structure exactly the way that heroin and cocaine alter the dopamine reward pathways by thinning out the dopamine receptors in the brain. So it's the same exact stuff. And actually,
I'm just wondering, is everybody getting this? This is really powerful stuff. So we know that cocaine and heroin, these white powders, are dangerous and they're addictive and they're not good for us. And they come from simple little harmless plants. Mm-hmm. And then we've got sugar and flour that are in everything that people are eating today. And they are just as addictive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just came across this study the other day, like 2 days ago. They took some rats and gave them a choice of being injected with intravenous cocaine or sucking down sugar water. And the rats preferred sucking down sugar water. And then they actually addicted the rats to cocaine. They hooked them on cocaine. And those hooked rats still preferred the sugar over the cocaine, even if they were already hooked on cocaine. And here's the other crazy thing. It worked for saccharin, too. So Sweet and Low, those little pink packets that people sweeten their food with, this process is actually mediated through the sweet taste buds. It's not a blood sugar a phenomenon. So it doesn't matter whether you're using Truvia or Stevia or Equal or Sweet and Low or whatever, or sugar or honey or corn syrup or agave or molasses. It's the activation of the sweet taste buds that hooks directly to the reward centers in the brain and hooks you. So in my program, in my Brightline Eating program, we eliminate all that stuff. Just get rid of it, because you just can't eat that stuff in moderation, you know, and stay, you know, the tagline I like to use is happy, thin, and free. You know, if you want to be happy, thin, and free, don't be eating that stuff.
I have to just take a moment and say that I'm very sorry for the rats that were in these experiments. I personally don't believe in animal experimentation, and you know, those rats on their own would not choose to consume coke or sugar. I mean, they're a lot smarter than we are.
Totally, totally. Yeah, I'm with you there. Sorry, rats.
But you know, we've learned a lot. But you know, we see this in humans all the time. We see this phenomenon. But, you know, we have to do the science before people are going to start talking about it in a sensible way.
But, you know, we see these effects. And, you know, for anyone out there who's saying, come on, sugar is not as addictive as heroin, I want to ask you, why do you think that 80,000 people in the United States this year are going to have a foot amputated for type 2 diabetes, and they know it's coming? They've been told by their doctor, if you don't stop eating sugar, we're going to cut off your foot. We're going to cut off your leg. And 80,000 people in 1 year, just this year, are going to have that happen to them. And another 25,000 are going to go blind. And they know it's coming. That is powerlessness. That is addiction. I don't know about you, but I don't know anybody who would willingly walk into blindness or a foot amputation if there was some simple change that they could make that was within their control to avoid it, right? What other explanation makes sense other than addiction? What else could possibly be the explanation?
Exactly, where we don't have control.
Yeah.
Whew. Now, you told me that some people, there are different kinds of people, and some people are more influenced by this kind of addictive power, and other people aren't. They have more control. How does that
work? That's right. That's right. Yeah, and it's just like any drug, actually. You know, lots of people, we know that alcohol is addictive, right? But lots of people drink a glass of wine here and there, or even two glasses of wine a night, right? Some people have heard, oh, a glass of wine every night is healthy, and they drink one glass of wine every night. And then other people, if they try to do that, they accelerate their drinking consumption, and before you know it, they're going to AA, right? For whatever reason, we've known historically that some people are addictable and some people aren't. And you might say, well, heroin's addictive for everybody. And I say, not really. Lots of people have surgery and go home with their Vicodin, and they take it even if they have chronic back pain. Some people take, you know, some kind of opiate for chronic pain regularly and never deviate from the doctor's prescribed instructions and never develop a habit that spirals out of control, even though it's a substance that is clearly addictive, and other people can't handle it, right? And it's the same with rats, again, back to the poor rats. But we've learned that one-third of rats are not addictable. They're just not susceptible to the addictive properties of various addictive agents. One-third of rats are somewhat addictable, and one-third of rats are highly addictable. And it looks like that for humans as well. So with our research on food addiction, one-third of the population, and this is some percentage of obese, overweight and normal weight individuals, some normal weight individuals, slender people as well, report being heavily addicted to food and not being able to control how much they're eating and how much they're thinking about food in between times and how much they get pulled by that addictive, you know, that craving, right? So, yeah, it's about one-third, one-third, one-third in terms of the population breakdown.
Okay, so what I think is encouraging about this, first, this information has to get out there because most people don't know it. But for people who really struggle with food addictions and they see all these other people around them who are not suffering, they think, you know, I can get over this myself because everybody else has got a handle on it. But you may, unfortunately, be one of those people, one-third of the population, that really struggles with addiction and need a better strategy.
Totally, totally. And I think, you know, what I call this is the susceptibility scale. You know, how susceptible are you to the addictive properties of refined foods or some other addictive substance? And I think an understanding of the susceptibility scale, I like to think of it as a scale from 1 to 10, or 0 to 10, right? Where, you know, people on the low end, the 1 through 3 or whatever, they're just never going to be affected. They just eat when they have to eat, and they don't think about it much in between times. And the 8s, 9s, and 10s, yeah, I agree with you. They're going to need something else. But if we all understood the susceptibility scale, it would clear up a lot of misunderstanding. For one thing, people think that some sort of diet and exercise regimen or healthy eating solution or, you know, program of action to lose weight or whatever is going to be a one-size-fits-all proposition. And that's really not the case. If you know where you're at on the susceptibility scale, you're much better armed with information about what type of program is likely to work for you.
So how do you find out where you are on the scale?
Well, Yale University does have a food addiction scale, which you can Google, just Yale University food addiction scale, and it'll come up, and you can take it. It's free online. But I think that actually most people can probably diagnose themselves. I mean, the simple questions are, you know, how much am I obsessed with food? Do I have the sense of feeling out of control over how much I eat? Once I start eating, is it hard to control the quantity of the food that I eat? Am I feeling pulled by cravings that I can't seem to shake? If you start to ask yourself these questions, you can probably get a sense of where you're at on the scale.
Okay, now let's just talk a little bit more personal about you, because you're just not some person that went off and studied this and was smart and is sharing this, but you have real personal experience with food and addiction.
Yeah, I do. I have decades of personal experience. Yeah, I'm a 10 on that spectrum. Yay me. Oh, it's the dubious luxury of being a perfect 10. This isn't the category that you want to be a perfect 10 in. Yeah, and I'm actually just highly addictable across the board. As a teenager, I got addicted to drugs and got really, I mean, I was addicted to crack as a teenager, really bad, and dropped out of high school the whole nine yards, super bad. I got clean and sober when I was 20, and my life got a whole lot better, but the addiction just transferred right over to food. And I think I'd been addicted to food before that. I mean, I, as a kid, I can look back and see the signs of food addiction in my early youth. I didn't quite have a weight problem yet. I had a weight problem starting at the age of 12. I was overweight. And I think I actually started doing drugs. My first hard drug was crystal meth, which makes you not want to eat. I mean, that's what that drug does, essentially, is it keeps you awake nonstop. And it makes you not want to eat. And I remember being so elated that I was dropping weight and no longer thinking about food, no longer obsessed with food. It took the food obsession right away. And that was for me the one of the primary attractors for me to that drug. So once I got clean, the weight piled on, and I knew it would, which was acceptable to me for a while. But then I hate being fat. I mean, I don't know if anyone loves being fat, but I think certain people are okay being heavy, and they've sort of, it's just kind of who they are, and they don't worry about it too much. I've never been that way. Every extra, you know, chunk of weight on my body just feels wrong. I sort of think, liken it to like someone who's transgender, like they're born a female, but they really deep down feel like they're male, or they're born male and they feel like they're female. Mm-hmm. I feel like deep down I'm a slender person, and I was just always living in this fat person's body. And I just, every time I'd catch my image in a mirror or a shop window or something going by, or in one of those awful video cameras and the security cameras, you know, in a store or something, and I'd catch my image, I'd go, really? Is that what I look like? I was always stunned that I was so fat. And never comfortable being heavy. And so I dieted, and you know, and not just diets, but like I was trying to do the real deal. I was trying to get happy, thin, and free. I was trying to, you know, get in shape and eat the right foods. And I feel like I tried everything. I mean, I spent, from the age of 12 when I first started dieting, I dieted nonstop and tried to lose weight and tried to get a whole, you know, I was a binger is what I was. I would just go off on these wicked binges. I was diagnosed with binge eating disorder when I was 23 or something like that, but I'd been doing it for a long time. I just finally got in front of a doctor who officially diagnosed me. And it wasn't until I was 28 that I found the solution that that I follow now, which is in the form of a 12-step program for food addiction. And I can't tell you which one because that's breaking my anonymity, but there's several of them. And, you know, you can just Google 12-step programs for food addiction. And that really worked for me. But over the years, I've been slender now. I took off all my weight. I'm 5'3", and I weigh like 110 pounds or something. I'm a size 4. I'm slender now, so my body is finally in alignment with what I always thought I should look like, but I've done it the right way. Like, I eat an abundant quantity of delicious, wholesome, whole foods. I think you'd be proud, Karen. I eat good stuff, you know? And but over the years, I've noticed why doesn't everybody go to a 12-step program for food addiction who has this problem or something similar to it? And I've just found that a lot of people don't prefer a 12-step program for their answer to things. I don't know why. I love 12-step programs. They've saved my life. But so that's kind of why I started Brightline Eating Solutions. My business is to bring this message of what works, both in terms of the brain science of it and the actual practicality of it, to people who are either maybe not tens on the scale, but, you know, somewhere in the 5 to 9 range, like they know they have a problem and they need something, or people who are real food addicts, you know, 10 on the scale, but they don't want to go to a 12-step program for food addiction for whatever reason. And so those are the people that I serve, because I've been working with people now for over 11 years. I've worked with hundreds of people, and there's a formula for taking off all your weight and getting free of the obsession with food. And it takes a lot of willingness, but if you're, you know, those are the people I'm looking for. I'm not in the convincing business. I'm just in the serving business, people who are willing, who are like, I'll do whatever. I'll eat shoe leather. I don't care. Just tell me what to do to get rid of this problem. You know, the people who are on the floor in the fetal position saying, there's got to be an answer for this. I'm so tired of being overweight and exhausted and, you know, binging on ice cream late at night when I know I don't want to be. You know, why do I keep eating these foods? And, you know, I can tell you why, and I can tell you what to do about it. So that's kind of the mission I'm on.
And you work with people individually. Is that what's different than the 12-step? Because in the 12-step program, you're in front of people.
Yeah, 12-step programs are, you know, in a group and going to meetings a lot and getting a sponsor and stuff like that. So my business is just starting, so I'm just a few months into business. But I just started my first boot camp, which is 40 people now that I'm taking through a course. I'm a college professor. I like to give courses. So I'm taking these 40 people through a course on bright line eating and what to do. Before the year is out, I'm going to have two more things added to my business model. I'm going to have a membership website, so a community online where people can belong to this community. They'll have their own login and their own ID, and they can get in there and they can educate themselves about about the problems that I'm talking about today. They can get support. There'll be chat threads. There'll be videos. There'll be webinars. And they can have access to all of that just by sort of joining the community. And then I'm also going to do an ongoing group coaching thing with 10 individuals. That's going to be my platinum group. I'll give the 40 people who are in the boot camp right now first dibs on those seats. But I'm sure over time seats will open up and stuff. And so I have an email distribution list where I send out information, just free information on the neuroscience and psychology of long-term weight loss maintenance and food addiction and sugar and flour, all the stuff I'm talking about. So I've almost got, I don't know, I've got like 750 people on that mailing list now, but I just started it a couple months ago. So it's growing really rapidly. I've added 300 people to the list just in the last 2 weeks.
There's a lot of people that need help. They're all addicted.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. Well, the thing is that the corporations that make a lot of this processed food, they know what you know. They know
yeah.
It's addicting.
Oh, they do. Oh, they do. They talk about, you know, getting mouth share and building developing heavy users. They talk about it like it's cocaine. Yeah. They mm-hmm. say we need more heavy users of our products.
Mm.
Yeah.
That's really scary. And I just want to get back because you mentioned that it's not just the real sugars, but it's also the artificial sugars, the ones that don't have calories.
Yeah.
That's important to know. They turn on the same lights. They do the same thing.
They do. So from the sweet taste buds to the addictive centers in the brain, they do exactly the same thing. So that's
so
one route.
People can be addicted to Diet Coke.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, without a doubt. Even without the caffeine in there. Yeah, decaffeinated yeah. Diet Coke. Totally addicted. Totally. But diet sweeteners also mess you up in a couple other ways. There's a recent paper that was just published that shows that diet sweeteners mess up the microbiome in your gut and leads to insulin and blood glucose deregulation. So for anyone who's got, you know, insulin resistance or leptin resistance, any of those problems, prediabetes, diabetes, artificial sweeteners are awful. They're like consistently messing with the gut flora. And they did this great study where they like transferred the gut flora from one animal to another and showed that it transfers over. And yeah, it's this, yeah. And then the other mechanism, which makes sense if you think about it, think about how the stomach and the brain work together, right? Like mm-hmm. you put food in your mouth and you can tell that it's like a rich, you know, high caloric meal, right? The brain sends a signal down to the belly that goes, you know, big bolus of calories is coming, you know, a big meal is on its way, get ready. And the stomach, you know, churns out its juices and starts to digest the food. Well, let's imagine now that you eat a whole bunch of stuff that's sweetened with artificial sweetener. Well, the tongue doesn't know that. It just tastes sugar. So the signal goes down to the stomach that says, ooh, a big bolus of calories is coming. But when it actually gets there, it's empty. There's nothing there. And so the stomach goes, liar, right? And what happens is when you consume artificial sweeteners, it breaks the signal from the brain to the belly, where basically the message of get ready, there's a whole bunch of calories coming, just gets broken. So people overeat because the belly doesn't believe what the brain is saying. And research shows that 70% of people have lost the ability to regulate their caloric intake naturally. Like a 2-year-old will regulate their caloric intake naturally. If they eat a huge meal, they yep. will not be hungry and they will refuse to eat for a
yep.
long time. It doesn't matter if you put, you know, ice cream in front of them. They won't eat it. They're full.
And that may, And that drives some parents crazy. You know, they don't realize their child knows when they've had enough to eat. They keep
totally.
Saying, eat more, eat more.
Totally, yeah. I counsel people on how to, you know, parent. I have three little kids myself. And letting them decide whether and how much to eat from what you provide is so important, because they're, you don't want to break that signal. It, like, the body knows when they're young, the body knows. By the age of 4 or 5 in our society, most kids have already lost that ability, unless they've been parented really, really well with food, because of all the sugar and all the crap that's in our food system now. It, you know, the brains are already getting broken.
We can get that back, right, when we start getting new helpful habits and eating better. We can reestablish that brain-stomach connection, right?
You know, I don't know that I have the world's most optimistic answer on that. I thought that after, well, let's see, this was like 2 or 3 years ago, I'd been doing Bright Line eating. By the way, the Bright Lines are no sugar, no flour, 3 meals a day, and weighed and measured quantities, like, or some kind of control on quantities. Those are the 4 Bright Lines. And I thought that after maybe, I think it was 8 years of doing this continuously, that I would have earned the right to just be a normal eater at this point. And so 2.5 years ago, I stopped doing Bright Line eating. And I was actually surprised at how quickly things unraveled for me. I was back to my old ways and binging, not as often as I used to, but periodically binging again and gaining weight again and feeling unmanageable with food again and feeling that sort of quiet desperation that I used to feel. It came back pretty quickly. So the answer is you can, I've found that you can live a life that looks exactly like perfect health and happiness, but you've got to keep it's just kind of window dressing. You've got to keep all the structures in place to keep it going. If you start to violate the principles and go back to your old ways, then you'll be back where, you know, if you keep doing what you always did, you're going to keep getting what you always got. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the one thing we know about the brain, and we've known for decades since research with the behaviorists in the 1930s, is that the brain doesn't ever really unlearn anything. Everything that you learned at some point, it might go underground, but it's still there. Those circuits are still there. So if you have right now an addictive, challenging, unmanageable relationship with food, and you find a way to clean it up, the only way to maintain that new level of freedom and health and happiness is to stick pretty diligently to whatever it was that allowed you to achieve that. You don't really ever get to just go back to being like other people are, or, you know, like those, like the 1/3 at the bottom of the scale. They just have a freedom around food that I will never have. They get to decide when and what they want to eat, and if they want to have a piece of cake, they have a piece of cake. I don't do that. But I got to say that I don't mind that, because for me, my personal path has been really through the food that I put in my mouth. And I have grown as a person so much by creating these bright lines and sticking with them and regaining my integrity as a person by sticking to my plan of what I'm going to eat. And I feel so good about myself for doing that, that I get so much more by following this way of life than I would just by being able to eat anything I want willy-nilly. I don't actually wish that I could do that. I get more by living this way than I would by living that way. It's a choice. It's a choice.
Yeah.
I choose not to eat that stuff today.
Well, I'm applauding you, Dr. Thompson. I'm glad you're taking that choice, and I'm glad you're sharing it with so many people who need this information. Thanks for joining me today on It's All About Food. I've learned so much every time I've talked with you.
Oh, thanks so much, Karen. It's been a real pleasure.
Now, where do people find you?
They can find me at www.happythinandfree.com. So it's all those
happy
words
thin.
Just spelled out, no spaces or anything. happythinandfree.com. Happythinandfree.com. And actually, I have a gift waiting for anyone who goes to that website. You can download a free report that's called The 3 Huge Mistakes That Almost Everyone Makes When They Try to Lose Weight.
Oh, thank you. That sounds great. I'm going to go there right now.
Cool.
Okay, thank you for joining me, and it's all about food.
All right, thanks, Karen. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye. And that's it. That's the end of this episode of It's All About Food. Thanks for joining me. I'm Karen Hartglass. Visit me at responsibleeatingandliving.com and send me your comments and questions to info@realmeals.org. And remember, have a delicious week. Bye-bye.